This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Good evening, everybody. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak radio show. Here, when the people speak, we make a difference. Sean Stone is the son of the controversial director Oliver Stone. He grew up in Hollywood, grew up in the world of film and filmmaking, has acted in some of his father's films, and now he has become a director in his own right with some upcoming films that I would love to talk to him about during the course of the show tonight. Sean graduated with a major in American history from Princeton University, and he completed his thesis on the New World Order, and that I want to touch base on. Hi, Sean. How are you this evening? Welcome.
Thank you. I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm wonderful. Thank you. I just found this to be quite fascinating. What an interesting and diverse. Ordinarily, we have activists and people that have dealt with a myriad of things in their life. But, you know, it isn't often that you have someone of such a controversial background, such renowned background, and that is involved in some of the things that you've been involved in, such as your recent conversion to Islam. Congratulations.
Thank you. Well, as we say, if it's, you know, within the same, if you're still worshiping the same God, and what's always been an interesting discussion is that it's not really, I don't call it a conversion, I call it an acceptance of Islam. And Muhammad is being a teacher, a prophet in the same lineage, going back to Abraham. So Moses and all the Jewish prophets, and then Jesus is considered a Christ, Messiah. But ultimately, you know, we think it's ultimately the same. They all serve the same God. So I'm Jewish, Christian, Muslim, I call myself.
Well, I think, you know, and one of the things that a lot of people don't know about Islam, I know this because I've grown up with Muslims most of my life. I happen to be a Palestinian Christian. And as a Christian from the famed Holy Land, this is common knowledge to me that a lot of people, especially the Muslims, believe that the Quran is just the continuation of this incredible saga of the one God, Allah. And,
exactly.
But I wonder why there's such a misunderstanding in the world today about this topic. I think it's amazing. I believe people are being miseducated, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, that's part of the reason that I actually accepted Islam, is to say that there should be more education in this regard. There should be more dialogue of civilizations between the religions, and we need to educate people as to the history of the religion of Islam itself, and how it's really, to my thinking, Muhammad was taking the Old Testament and New Testament and educating the Arab diaspora with it, and through the Quran. Basically, he took those books from the West, and well, not really from the West, they were more prominent in the West at the point, but the point is that, as you say, they all originate in this region, and he takes those books and he writes the Quran, and he educates the Arab world in those teachings of the Old Testament and New Testament. And that's why the extra Sharia law is Mosaic law. And so really they're just practicing the same laws that were passed down to Abraham and Moses by the one God, however you want to call him or her, or it, that supreme source, creator.
Mm-hmm.
And they just call it, Allah, but it's really the one God. So to accept Islam is just to say that you give Muhammad respect as a prophet of that same God, going back to Abraham's God.
Well, you know, I always laugh. I have to tell you, I have been known to mock people that have laughed at the name of Allah, saying, "Well, that's not God. Allah is not the name of God. God is God." And I laugh and I say, "Well, did you know that in the Arab world they don't speak English?"
That's my favorite. Actually, I've heard a Catholic. I had a Catholic woman say that to me. She goes, "I said, well, what's it? First of all, I said God has no name." Because God is, as far as I'm concerned, God has many infinite number of names. You know, it's the Creator. No, God has a name, God. I'm like, well, I'm glad Jesus spoke English. I mean, people really think that in this country. I mean, Americans have said this on, you know, on TV. There are Americans that, you know, say, well, if the Spanish, you know, the Mexicans in America should speak English, because if English was good enough for Jesus, it's good enough for the Mexicans.
Amen, brother.
You know, what is this ignorance that we're propagating through our media? Frankly, it's I blame media for a lot of this. The fact that we allow these stereotypes to exist, you know, in general.
I have to admit that I believe a little bit has to do with our educational system at this point. If they haven't figured out yet that other nations speak different languages, we've got a serious problem here going on in America.
Right. But, you know, overall, we love this. I mean, our history shows us we love to create these enemies. And it's like, you know, whether it's the black, you know, black people, and you get the stereotypes around black people. And it came out pretty badly around Katrina when a lot of, you know, even liberals were saying, well, you know, blacks just can't get it together. See what they're doing in, you know, in Louisiana, New Orleans was just, it was a nightmare. And, you know, they kind of deserved it. You know, it was like, there's this continuous us and them creation. And frankly, I studied it in one of my theses at I think it was at Oxford at the time. I was studying how a lot of the Puritan rhetoric around the early wars against the Indians it was in Narragansett of New England. And the point was that the Puritan rhetoric was a war on evil, a war on terror. There was very much the precedent of the war on evil in their rhetoric at the time. And that's what I was studying, was this comparison of the two and how much it was, you know, it was we're God's people, we're the chosen ones, and we're essentially, you know, here to cleanse the earth of those who don't believe in our God, regardless of, you know, they were trying to create the Indians. They actually called the Indians terrorists. I mean, it wasn't that exact word, but essentially they were, you know, savage, barbarian. You know, they massacred women and children, innocents and whatnot. So that always justifies our killing of innocents. You know, it's like, how can you, it goes on and on, right? You know, they kill our innocent people. They kill 3,000 people in the World Trade Center, but we kill a million people in Iraq and we don't count, you know, how many women and children were killed in that. I mean,
well, no, it became because we're very sensitive here in America. After Vietnam, we were told that they would no longer count enemy dead because the American public couldn't handle the, and were too sensitive to have to deal with the numbers of people that died. And I thought to myself, well, that's terrible. I can't even imagine that. But that's what we have been reduced to accepting in this country. And I believe that it is a reduction in our intelligence. One of the things I really want to get to the nitty gritty of, and this is where you really cause controversy. You went to Iran and you got Islamified.
Well, of all places,
how did you manage that? Talk to me about that, Sean. How did you get to Iran? What were the circumstances behind your going to Iran? And may I ask you one other thing? When you went to Iran, was it your intention to go to take the Shahada?
No, I've been twice now because I'm working on some co-productions. We have basically have like 3-4 films in development. That would be ideally filmed there. And the first project that was brought to me was a film about Rumi. And I went to meet with the production company and frankly, my hosts, both of whom are westernized. One is an Iranian man who lives in Canada and goes back and forth. And he's a producer as well as his partner, who's actually an American woman, born in Kentucky, white woman, who accepted Islam in her 20s, I think, and has been living in Iran for the last few years since she's been working there as a, both of them trying to basically do these East-West co-production. So I felt, you know, it's about time to do that, and, you know, have obviously a dialogue with the Muslim world, but also especially with Iran, because I was fascinated by the idea of a country that's supposed to be part of this axis of evil and is completely behind the new Iron Curtain, if you want to call it.
And, the one that's so being drawn as we speak.
Exactly. So I was curious. And I went to just sort of check out the film industry there 6 months ago or 7 months ago now. And then I went back again in, I guess it was March this year, or February, March, I can't remember anymore. Time is speeding up, it feels. But it was about a month ago. And so I went there, and I'm developing a couple projects, one of which is on Rumi, one of which is on djinns, or genies, as we call them. Mm-hmm. And so when I was, when I was there, I had a, if you want to call it, revelation about accepting Islam and simply stating it openly. And, you know, I never had a problem with Muhammad historically, having studied, you know, the Crusades, a little bit of Islam at college, and seeing the religion in practice in Iran. You know, it's a very spiritual country, frankly. I found it spiritually purifying. It's a place where you go and you don't see much advertising and marketing and commercialization. People, you know, they still look you in the eye. They don't walk around on their cell phones all the time, you know, on their Facebook. They have it, but there's still a personable culture. There's a relationship to the family, which is very sacred. There's a relationship to God, which is internal, and you can't really describe it, but you feel it. You sense the faith. And, you know, I was very much touched by it. And I went to visit the shrine, the burial ground of Joshua, actually. And this is an interesting question. If Joshua, the prophet who was supposed to lead the Israelis into Israel, is actually buried in Isfahan, Iran. Mm-hmm. And, of course, this goes back to the whole question of whether or not Israel was ever, if Canaan was ever in Palestine, or if, in fact, this was not invention of later Babylonian captivity.
Well, I know for a fact they certainly have not found any archaeological evidence to substantiate the claims yet. So I'm still waiting for that one.
Exactly. So this has more to do, Israel has more to do with the Crusader Kingdom, right? Historically, those are the boundaries of what the Catholic Crusaders had imposed. And it stretched obviously to Lebanon, but what is now Israel is really just the Crusader Kingdom all over again from 1,000 years ago. And whether or not there ever was an Israel there, you know, I don't believe it yet. As you say, there's no archaeological evidence of it. But the Iranians believe that Joshua died in Isfahan, and they have his tomb there. So I went to visit it, and it's a site of pilgrimage for the Muslims. And, you know, Joshua's very much respected as one of the line of prophets. Mm-hmm. And so, in the course of that, I don't know, I just had a vision to accept Islam and incorporate that into my spiritual faith, and just state it openly, frankly, because that's all it really is, stating openly that Muhammad is a prophet of God. And because of that one statement, you know, some people are ready to kill you for it, and others will glorify you. And, you know, to me, it's just there's one God. It's not, you know, it's not difficult to accept that Muhammad is also his prophet.
And while in Iran, you met with some very controversial people, including Ahmadinejad.
Yeah.
Can you talk to us about your meeting with him?
Well, it was very brief. I mean, the truth is that I have, you know, I had some interesting meetings with bureaucrats, you know, from different branches, and including, you know, frankly, I had the longest meeting with one of Khamenei, the Supreme Leader's Supreme Leader Khamenei, one of his guys. And so, you know, this when it comes to the politicians there, these are very well-educated people, a lot of them trained in the West, you know, very sophisticated and, you know, intelligent. They're just, there's an interesting dialogue to be had with Ahmadinejad. Personally, I didn't speak for a very long period of time, except that he told me, you know, that they didn't want a nuclear bomb, let's say. He said, no bomb, categorically. But we didn't get into the politics regarding Israel, I got that. I got more into that with some of the other politicians because I was trying to basically express that they should get, you know, we all agree in the sense that we're opposed to the empire. We're opposed to the, what I call the British Empire. It's really an Anglo-American empire that, you know, includes Zionism. And that's the structure that the Iranians are opposed to. And I said, on that regard, you know, you should stop the rhetoric against Israel and against America and say down with the empire. That's something much more palatable that we can, I think, we can agree to and many people across the world can agree to. Right now, the rhetoric of, you know, down with America, down with Israel, that just sets people off. And it's frankly untrue. So I was trying to convey that to them, to the politicians that I met with there. And they got it. Hopefully they'll listen to me, but who knows? And then, you know, I said, frankly, when it comes to Israel, Iran should lay down some kind of statement as to like how to, you know, how are we going to resolve this Israel-Palestine conflict, which has been ongoing. And my father did a documentary on it 10 years ago. And actually, I went with him. We went to Jerusalem and Ramallah. And we were there actually right during the invasion. The Israelis invaded Ramallah and destroyed Arafat's compound after one of the bombings. And so we actually got out of Ramallah just before, like we were the last car out, I think, pretty much, because they'd already closed the border. And we really were lucky to escape with the Canadian diplomats. So we had, you know, we've seen a little bit of what life is like for the Palestinians there. And, you know, I'm opposed to the occupation of the West Bank. There's a lot of problems with the, you know, obviously with the Israeli policy. And so I can sympathize, but I also, you know, I'm not someone to say Israel should be wiped out. I mean, it's too late. It exists. It's not going to disappear. So there's, I mean, but I'm all about dialogue, and I'm open to, you know, I think the Iranians could present some kind of, you know, forums to discuss how we're going to make peace in the, between this, between these parties, essentially. And, you know, just frankly, they should take the initiative on that, because I don't think that the empire wants peace. You know, I don't think that there's no profit in peace. The profit is in conflict and chaos and war, which our empire, the Anglo-American empire, is currently fomenting.
Well, first of all, I'd like to ask you how you loved my lovely town of Ramallah. That was where I was born.
You're born in Ramallah, really?
Yes, I was born on the West Bank in Ramallah. And I still have lots of family there, lots of friends. We travel to and from when we can, of course. That's kind of limited and restricted to us to a certain extent. And but yeah, I was born in Ramallah, so it's a beautiful town. Don't you agree?
It is. I mean, it was a very depressing time I was there. It was really
Tough. Unfortunately, when you speak of the time that you were there, it was very, very depressing, very sad. As a matter of fact, people were no longer even celebrating things like weddings or anything like that because of the Great Depression that had befallen the country, based on the occupation and the occupational forces there. So it was a very bad time.
And frankly, I mean, it's really clear how it works. I mean, the Israeli settlers have occupied the hilltops around the city, and that's open. They have these connecting roads, right? That are basically Palestinians are barred from using the roads, and they're, you know, exclusive access roads. And then, as the as some of the, you know, the Palestinians told us, the settlers, at least at that time, didn't really work out there. They slept there. You know, the whole point was it really was a settlement for occupation purposes. They occupied that. They built houses. They would sleep there, and they'd go to work in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem or, you know, somewhere else. But the point was that whenever they had conflict, they could bring artillery to the hilltops and then
exactly.
Fire.
And the hilltops were always the vantage point for any kind of military strategy. They're pretty fascinating, and oftentimes, and this is something that unless you've been to the West Bank and have actually witnessed what these white scathing settlements look like all over the hilltops throughout the valleys and the hills of Palestine. No one can really know because they don't show them on television. You'll never see If you see the settlements, you'll see a close up, maybe a doorway going into, but you'll never see the look of them. And it's quite glaring if you're in the territory and as you were, so you can see them.
You never see the settlers. You never see the settlers carrying machine guns.
Never see that. We see it all the time.
You see them like peaceful, they're peaceful settlers. Well, they walk around with machine guns and whatnot. It's the Wild West.
It's a very interesting
Indian country.
Yeah, absolutely. Very interesting. But obviously, having gone to all of these incredible places, now I've never been to Iran. I have traveled through the Middle East. And I have traveled as a Christian through the Middle East. So I know that, the majority of this insanity that everybody claims is rampant in the Middle East against Christians, and they're just running around murdering and marauding and doing all these horrible things to Christians. And I'm not suggesting for one minute that there is no animosity between the religions. That's a historic animosity. There is this continuation that people that continually will say, well, our religion is the only religion. And in the end, we all say the same things. All of the religions say the same things. And it's unfortunate. And I rather like the idea of continuations of the same belief systems that the Muslims have introduced. Am I Muslim? No. Do I understand that there could very well be a continuation of these religions? I'm absolutely convinced that there should be. Even if this isn't the one, I don't know that it's the one or it isn't. I just know that I don't have any problem with Islam. I don't have any problems with Muslims. Some of my best friends are Muslim, and some of my best friends are Shia Muslims. And in the Middle East, the Shia are considered a more conservative of the Islamic factions.
It's funny, isn't it? I mean, if you think about, because the Wahhabis are what we consider the most extreme or radical form of Taliban and the kinds the ones that blow themselves up and whatnot, and that's of course Sunni, Saudi Sunni. So it goes across the spectrum. The Shia, I agree, I think, but they're also feared for that reason, because they're feared for the reason that not so much being conservative, but being very connected to the idea of martyrdom, having to do with the death of Hussein and the Prophet's family, and the fact that they really died as martyrs against caliphate. And so I know people who are even Sunni Muslim who tell me, if I chose, I would probably choose Shia, because they are the rebels. They're the ones who didn't just go along to get along. The first caliphate in a sense was all about power. And so a lot of this is they'll tell me what's beautiful with the Shia is they'll stand for the repressed. They stand for the underclass. That's the tradition of Shia Islam, is that you're supposed to be ready to martyr yourself for the common man, for the person who's repressed, who's suffering, who's being, persecuted.
Let me ask you, Sean, in light of these incredible revelations that you have experienced in your life, how has the Hollywood community received you?
Well, at first, I think it was obviously shocking for some people around me who, the initial week, I think there were people who I'm working with, producers, who were telling me that the investors or people they were dealing with were just curious to know what was going on, if I was basically becoming a jihadi or something. I mean, because there's so much negativity associated with Islam at this point. So that, as soon as you openly talk about it, I mean, I know for a lot of, Muslims in Hollywood who've come to me now, basically congratulate me, and they kind of they change their name, frankly. They don't really, a lot of Muslims will go under pen names. They'll work, under, Jewish names or just Christian names or whatnot, to not be seen as Muslim, usually. So my advantage is that, it's a very white name. Sean Stone can be anything. It's a very, it's generic. And aside from calling the fact of conversion to myself by stating it publicly, I was carried on, and no one would have known. But I think it was important for me to say, I accept Islam. I'm Jewish, Christian, Muslim. My name indicates that John Christopher Ali Stone, because now Ali is my Muslim name. And so I think by making it more pronounced, at least you know, sowing the seed and making a gesture and saying, there is, you know, there's a brotherhood, it's a commonality between all of us as people. And at the end of the day, you know, your religion, I'm not saying I'm just trying to proselytize it, but I want people to recognize and respect the religion, you know, as it should be respected. It's a beautiful religion, and it's growing, and it's, it encompasses almost a third of the world's population.
It is profound, and you know, it's interesting that you said that a lot of the Muslims in Hollywood are changing their names, and I know that that is a fact. And part of the problem is, and what I see as the problem is, this is the same. Is this not similar to what happened to the Jews that profess this allegiance to this anti-Semitic this word anti-Semitism, like they own it, and they don't.
Yeah. They don't. It's semi.
They don't own it.
Palestinian. They're, yeah, exactly. They can be. They can be a Muslim as well. They can be Semites. Mm. That's absolutely true.
And as a Palestinian, I too am a Semite. I have this lovely green tinge to my skin, olive green. On my census report, I always put other, and then I put green.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you know, at the end of the day, ignorance is the root of all evil. I really believe in what Plato said in this regard, and I'm launching a website called thewaronevil.com, because evil is based in ignorance, and it's mostly our chosen ignorance that's the worst. You see, I have no problem with people being unaware of things. Every one of us is unaware. I'm unaware of things, but I desire to know, and I'm still, you know, I'm open to listening and hearing.
I love that, Sean. I love that. You desire to know. I love that.
But that's the basis of, you know, that's the basis of goodness. Goodness is predicated in a desire to know and a desire to hear the opposite point of view, to expose yourself to it, challenge yourself, and then you're able to, you know, you're able to then learn and grow. If you refuse to hear the other point of view, if you refuse to accept anything that doesn't fit your frame of the world, ultimately, it's a satanic point of view, because we know the universe is infinite and it's growing and it's alive. So hence, because of growth, because of change, dynamic change in time, you can never be stuck in one point of view. It's already going to be outdated. By the next moment, it's already being transformed. So we have to constantly wage war against this evil of reticence of being ossified, of being stagnant.
I think we have to change the terminology. We really don't want to continue to wage war on it. We want to wage knowledge and information onto the people so that they can understand and see the light and the truth.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think fighting and war also have positive. See, even war and fighting actually have a positive connotation. You know, you have to embrace the fight, the struggle.
Because, well, then, you know, this is actually a perfect segue into what is looming in most people's minds today. This impending disastrous event that people call a war on Iraq, they're not really calling it a war on Iraq. They're calling it a limited war, targeting limited objects that would last only for a few days or for a few weeks, and there are not going to be any real serious consequences. That's an impossibility, is it not, Sean?
Well, I'll tell you, it's even worse than that. The actual war is being waged against the American people, and it's pretty much what I pointed out when I came back. I was on Russia Today in, I went in February, because I came back, and on the verge of March 1st, I said, we're now about to enter martial law in this country, because the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012 goes into effect on March 1st. And what does the National Defense Authorization Act that Obama asked for allow? It allows the detention of U.S. citizens by our military indefinitely without trial. And, of course, this is, you know, Obama, the man who assassinated American citizens in Yemen last year, saying, oh, well, I would never use this against the American people, but why did you call for it? You know, even Carl Levin in the Senate said that, you know, the initial draft did not, the initial draft precluded American citizens from that. It disqualified American citizens. And Obama, the administration, said, no, put them in, U.S. citizens as well. The war is on us. People have to get this out of their heads that we're fighting in Iran or abroad. The war is the American people. What Obama represents is the British Empire, the Anglo-American Empire that's mm-hmm. taken over. It's the war of the British Empire against the American Republic. We never stopped fighting it after 1776. As we recall, there was an 1812 war where they burned the White House, this is the original White House, down. We won that, but the Civil War was exactly this continuation of the fight. The British were supporting the South against the North. They were causing secession because the British always used civil war as a device of destroying the nation state. And then that's what's happening in Syria, essentially. It's the same policy. But the reason that the British took hold in our country is because of what became known as the New World Order, a phenomenon. As opposed to having a formal empire by the end of the last century, or I'm sorry, the end of the 19th century, the British, particularly Cecil Rhodes, you know, people around the Rockefeller, Rothschild, mm-hmm. I'm sorry, of England, started drafting proposals for a secret society that would be predicated on the purpose of incorporating America back into the fold and maintaining the empire through informal purpose, informal means, informal being the Commonwealth, for example.
How does Israel play into this, Sean?
Well, Israel, don't forget, is a Rothschild creation. Essentially, the whole Zionist movement was largely financed by the Rothschilds, and by the time of the Balfour Declaration, which is the British, you know, policy paper of, I think it's 1917, they carved up the Middle East. They created all these states. They created Kuwait by cutting Iraq away from it. They created, you know, the Saudi regime. They created the Jordanian regime. All these regimes are propagated by the French and British empires. It's a Sykes-Picot treaty. You know, no mm-hmm. one. It was not about giving anything of a real national consequence to the peoples of the region. It was about how the British and French wanted to maintain their rule there. And at that point, they decided they were going to create a Zionist state. And the question was how to go about doing it.
Exactly. And then the plan developed. And one of the things that I've always said is that during the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the division of the so-called Middle East, and I'm using my fingers as quotation marks here, because nobody really ever knew what it was the middle of, but they dubbed it the Middle East, and ergo the Middle East. But what they ended up doing was dividing these lands in strategic ways to keep dissension in the Middle East. And the dissension played itself out, and now everybody's upset about it. Why? Mm. This was the exact design of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, to continue conflict in the region.
Yeah. Well, the why is very simple. if anyone bothered to read Zbigniew Brzezinski's book in 97, he wrote The Grand Chessboard. And Brzezinski, of course, was the guy basically was running Jimmy Carter's foreign policy in the, you know, late 70s. He created the Afghan War against the Russians. He admitted it by saying that we actually dispatched Mujahideen into Russia across their border, and this is before they invaded. So we basically provoked their invasion of Afghanistan in the 80s and then ran the whole Afghanzi army against them throughout the 80s. So that's Brzezinski's policy. In 97, he writes a book called The Grand Chessboard. And he goes back to Halford Mackinder and the whole British strategy of the heartland. Because to these people, you see, this is the New World Order thing. Russia, China, Germany, this whole Eurasian region, the Eurasian land bridge, is about half the world's population or more. All the arable lands, all the resources you need. It's so wealthy that it cannot be allowed to ever prosper or grow according to national determination. And that was the issue of the American Republic. The beauty of the American Republic by the end of the Civil War was that our industrial progress was a model for the rest of the world. Germany picked it up through Bismarck and company, and basically they were promoting industry in Germany, and it allowed Germany to become a great rival with the British by the time of the First World War.
It was a blooming society.
Exactly. It was all based on industry, science, technology, industry, nation states. But you have to have a nation state to allow that to happen. The Chinese had Sun Yat-sen, who studied our model. The Russians had Kanpit, and it was a model of Nicholas II, I believe, who freed the serfs. And the Japanese had the Meiji Restoration. All these were nationalist movements. that was going to basically allow the heartland to grow. Well, I'm sorry, the heartland, Eurasia, to blossom, and not it would not rely upon British mercantile trade, free trade, mercantile policies anymore. And once these countries become strong sovereign nations, able to basically have a harmony of interests between their working class and their industrial class, it's over for the British Empire. So what do they say? The heartland, which is the region of the Middle East, which is a term that they coined anyway, which is, you know, from the Red Sea, which obviously is where, you know, the Straits of Hormuz, which is where all this trade is conducted. From the Horn of Africa, north to Turkey, east to India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, that is what's called the heartland of Eurasia. That region right there must be destabilized, because if you destabilize it, you basically are destabilizing the border of the south underbelly of Russia and the western border of China.
I know for a fact what I understand. I believe that America had intentionally set out to destabilize the Middle East upon its attack on Iraq originally, and this is just a continuation of this destabilization, because until they destabilize, they've already destabilized Syria. Now and unless they destabilize Iran, which happens to be their greatest threat at this point in the Middle East, they really haven't won anything, have they?
Well, this is where the British Empire you're talking about. This is the British Empire faction in the United States. Brzezinski represents this, and Brzezinski, you remember, was Obama's chief strategist going into his campaign.
Yes.
And his presidency. You know, it was known that Brzezinski was his top foreign affairs advisor.
Mm-hmm.
And Brzezinski represents these guys because they're all trained in the British Empire model of government. The reason I think they want to do it is because financially they are dead. Their Wall Street is toast, bankrupt. They bailed it out to no effect, because at the end of the day, the avail was only for them to buy up, you know, other banks, and for the big banks to get bigger and to continue their speculation.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing sustainable about their model. Their model is going to sink. It's going to blow up. And are they going to take the whole world with them? Are they going to basically blow up these countries and try to carve out some kind of, deals as they would do, like, for example, in the Congo, the last dozen years of civil war, where they make deals with various barons down there for gold?
Mm-hmm.
And
well, wasn't that one of the deals that we had made with Saddam Hussein?
Exactly. But then the point is, what I think Saddam Hussein's gold vault was raided. That was the point. Once he was out, all his gold was looted. Libya, once Gaddafi made the deal, I think it was with J.P. Morgan to basically handle his finances, that was the point that he was ousted. So once we can have some kind of hold on in terms of seizing the assets of these countries, then it becomes advisable to actually overthrow them. The problem, of course, is that you're dealing with the Russians and the Chinese. And they don't want to see their countries destabilized by the chaos we're creating on their border. And
exactly.
That's why the real threat is going to be how far, you know, how close we're going to go to World War III in this context.
And how far are they going to allow America and Israel to take this?
Well, precisely. I mean, no one expected. I mean, when Cheney was messing around in Georgia, Russia one day just invaded South Ossetia. I mean, it was like the Russians showed up. Same with Serbia, by the way, in 1999 during the Kosovo War. One day, all of a sudden, who ended it? The Russians. You know, then you don't know how quickly they're going to strike. So from our perspective, you know, it's like, oh, we can just bomb some enrichment facility in Iran or one or two bases. But what are the Russians going to do about it? And
you
what
know,
are the Iranians
what
going to
surprises
do? Because the Iranians
me.
Are not a pushover. You know, they're not going to
you know what really gets
down.
Me, though, Sean? This is the thing that's most astonishing to me here growing up in America. I was born in the West Bank, but I grew up in America. I'm an American citizen. I love this country. But I'll be quite honest with you, it's got me completely confused lately. Here we are on a constant system of attacking Iran, challenging it on every turn, defending our actions, surrounding its borders, blowing up all of the roads entering on the Iraqi side of the border, on entering and exiting Iran in preparation for war. We are building currently hospitals along the far eastern section in order to accommodate for the unfathomable devastation that we anticipate will happen. And our political candidates are actively seeking an attack on Iran, saying we must attack Iran. Our president is talking that way. Everybody, and then they're saying, well, Iran is a threat to us. Who's a threat to who?
Well, at the end of the day, as I said, right now the policy is total war. I think McCain was the one who said it at the end of last year when they started to introduced the NDAA in Congress. The wording was, we're going for a total war. America is now part of the battlefield. The whole planet is the battlefield. And anyone who can read into this is going, NDAA being introduced now is preparation for martial law. Because where's the threat? I mean, where's the existential threat to America from these so-called bands of al-Qaeda terrorists? You know, it's like we live in 1984. I mean, you could literally say, I'm al-Qaeda because I met with someone from, I met somebody in Iran who might have, met someone else who could have been so-called al-Qaeda, so that makes me al-Qaeda. I mean, it's like that's the kind of logic that we're putting ourselves into. And we're putting ourselves under the control of what is a tyrant. I mean, Obama is that. His executive orders everything is indicating preparation for martial law in this country. You see it on a daily basis in the attitude of the TSA, the idea of implementing more and more of these border patrols within our country, because already they have border patrols inside New Mexico. I mean, I remember going through one, I think it was in New Mexico, in the middle of the state, border security. We're not on the border. How can you set up a border security in the middle of a highway? How can you deploy drones, freely within this country? How can you, basically allow people to be strip searched every time they're arrested, unless you're preparing for total martial law? Because it's step by step, you have to break down the psychology to say it's okay to walk through a TSA security X-ray, which we don't even know the consequences. The Europeans won't allow it into Europe, but we don't mind being X-rayed, and we don't mind putting our arms up like a guilty person. It's like, I feel like you're being walked through a concentration camp every time you go through this X-ray.
Well, I believe that the solidifying force was the National Defense Authorization Act that Obama signed on March 16th of this year.
That's exactly it.
No one
feels it yet. No one feels it yet. They say, well, it hasn't bothered me. But, every day you're seeing small things. Step by step, they're preparing it. So all it's going to take is one day, someone starts disappearing. People could be disappearing right now. We don't know.
And I don't understand why people don't see this progression of this progressional system of a takeover of our lives and our freedoms and our rights. They just don't see it.
Yeah.
And yet every single day we tell them more and more is happening, and then all of a sudden everybody gets all upset and says, well, what about NDAA? Well, what about it? We've been toting that since the Patriots Act 12 years ago now. Are you kidding me? I do have a couple of questions, Sean, for you from audience participators. So one of them is, how old are you?
Me? 27.
27. God, you're so smart for a 27-year-old. And the second one is, Peter in Arizona asks, what does Sean think about the Shanghai Cooperation Organization?
Shanghai Cooperation Organization?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know enough about it.
I'm not going to lie either. I don't know enough about it to even, begin a dialogue on it.
I've heard it referred to, I think, in the context of a Russia-China-India cooperation economically, which, I told the Iranians, I said, look east, if the Americans cut you off and they declared war, essentially, by embargoing you on all fronts, look towards developing your industries with the Russians and the Chinese, because at the end of the day, there has to be some semblance of industrial progression for people. It's not happening in this country. We're not building maglevs. We're not building nuclear power plants. We're not going to nuclear fusion processes and beyond electromagnetic. I mean, there's so many energy technologies we could be using. And the fact that we don't, that these politicians still joke about this, this oil dependency, it's like you have to be buy that. There's no reason we're still on oil as far as you know, our cars and our power plants and whatnot.
Absolutely no reason. Now, I know we've only got a short time, Sean, and I wanted to really my position on this knocking out of the alleged nuclear sites. For me, that would require expanding the geographic scope of the war. I don't care what anybody says. I don't care what myth you or what cloud you're living under. If you don't understand that, we will be expanding the scope of the war. It will not stop at nuclear sites. Do you agree with this?
I don't agree with ever launching bombs at anyone unless you're declaring war on them. And if you're in the, you can't sit there and expect, you know, I pose the same thing to Americans. If Russia, said we're going to knock out your nuclear facility because we don't want you to have nuclear bombs, and they then launched, you know, an attack on it, would we not perceive that as an attack on our country? Would we not retaliate? How are the Iranians going to retaliate? You know, think about that. There's a reason that our military has been so opposed over the last few months. I mean, that was the thing. When I came back, I was initially standing up for Iran against this aggression, this warmongering from the media. And by the end of the week, the head of the Joint Chiefs and Panetta had all come out saying, you know, Iran is a rational actor. We're not supportive of preemptively striking this country at this point. And they, you know, there's a reason they're saying that. So whoever it is within our government or military who's suggesting it, I don't consider them part of the nationalist faction that doesn't want to see, you know, World War III, because if you do launch missiles, you do not know where this is going to end.
Absolutely. Sean, quickly, can you tell me what's your new projects that are coming up on the horizon?
Yeah. one is about paranormal activity. It's actually set in an abandoned mental hospital called Greystone. The film is coming out in September, it looks like. And it's based on our...
Is that scary? Because I don't like scary.
It's pretty
scary. Spooky. Scares me.
Yeah. It's definitely, it's all
creepy.
About that haunted realm, paranormal realm, shadows and ghosts, demons. So it's really good. It's cool, though. It's been a long time in the process. You know, it took about 2.5 years. It'll be 3 years from the time that we actually started breaking into these mental hospitals and exploring, looking for ghosts and finding them. Demons, too.
Your dad's proud of you. Dad, what are you doing today? Well, I've been breaking into the mental hospitals and exploring.
Well, you know, honestly, he encouraged it, actually. It was very funny. My dad actually plays a cameo in the film. It's based on the truth, you know, what happened. As I said, it's based on a true story. So he plays himself in, like, this opening dinner table conversation, which really happened, where I met this guy, Alex Wraith, who's my co-writer and co-actor in the film. And, you know, he starts telling us about these this mental hospital in Jersey that he's been exploring. It's kind of like The Shining, you know. You have to see it to believe it, and then when you see it, you're not really sure you can believe your eyes anymore.
That's so pretty cool stuff.
I want to see this for myself.
Well, that's pretty cool stuff. When is it going to be coming out?
So that should be September.
Wonderful.
For video on demand.
Looking forward to it.
Hopefully,
I won't go, but I will send my family to see it.
Yeah,
I said exactly. I won't go, but I'll send my family to see it. They love creepy stuff.
Oh yeah, I mean kids will love it because it's young people breaking into and doing everything you're not supposed to do. You're not supposed to go break into that haunted mental hospital down the road. It's like, all right, let's go for it. You know what? I want to encourage.
I hope I've taught them better than that so far.
No, it's time for civil disobedience, right? We need to encourage this more often.
A little bit.
So the authorities tell you don't go there. Well, why don't they want you to go inside these places? What's going on in there? Let's find out if there's really ghosts. Set up some monitors and to do a scientific experiment. I'm pretty sure there are, you know, there's other dimensions of reality that are being withheld from us, but why can't we just do some kind of public survey?
I absolutely know there are. I walk in different dimensions throughout my whole life, so I have no doubts as far as that. And I think it's about time people are starting to address these issues. And I want to thank you for being with us tonight, Sean. This has been a fascinating interview. I wish you luck on Greystone. I wish you luck on Rumi and your documentary on the Jinn. I'm looking forward. I definitely will see those. And
the jinns are creepy too, right? I mean, jinn are kind of like our demons, right? Our version.
Yeah, but you know, as an Arab, I'm used to listening to hearing about jinn.
Well, the Americans aren't, so that'll be cool to show them.
But it was wonderful having you. Thank you, Sean, for being with us. Sean Stone, ladies and gentlemen, look out for his films. He is a force to be reckoned with, and he's Muslim.
Well, Jewish Christian Muslim.
There you go. Now, I don't know if I should have ended it that way, but thanks, Sean, for being with us tonight. It's been a pleasure. Truly, it has been.
Thank you so much. Have a good night.
That's all, folks. Remember, let the people speak.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.